There is an undercurrent of diverse perspective that flows through our cultural continuum. It has always been there, and it contributes greatly to collective conscience and ethical standards that are always strained, especially when politics are controlled by economics. The great wave of counterculture that emerged in America, beginning in the 1950s, extending into the present, remains our cultural vanguard. Counterculture has many countenances, many subcultures of practice that have had enormous impact in shaping mainstream culture today. The counterculture persists to this day, is a tribute to the diversity of perspective of which we are capable. For Voices of Counterculture, this is Jack Leffler. Peter Coyote has been an enduring voice of counterculture for over half a century. He speaks of his perceptions.
I got that sense of cultural continuum from Gary Snyder. He was the first guy that was enough of a scholar that could ever talk about it in such a way that I could see, like I knew I was beholden to the Beats, but I didn't know that the Beats were necessarily beholden to Hart Crane, and Hart Crane and those guys were beholden to Thoreau and the Transcendentalists. And suddenly, once I was given that concept of the great underground to deal with, I thought, holy shit, this is completely legitimate. This is as old as civilization, probably older. You know, because Gary was the first guy that got me thinking about the Paleolithic. I thought, oh man, it's not this idea of progress on the point of an arrow and, you know, the present is always the most highly evolved evolutionary place. It ain't that at all. It's that there are two different imaginings of the world. And the one that's showing all the cultural artifacts and the machinery and the high-tech whiz-bangs, which it's using as evidence of its advanced development, is, you know, not necessarily the right model at all. You know, it's like being on the Titanic and the captain comes running out and says, the pool's open and the water's fine, come on in. I see that there's another understanding, there's another way to live. And even though I may wear a suit and tie, or I may dress like everybody else and drive like everybody else, I'm doing everything I can to stay awake and keep my intuitions tuned and do what I can, from riding a motorcycle every day to get 40 miles to a gallon at least, to participating every time I'm given an opportunity to lend energy to an expression of something that feels consonant with this intuitive, earth-loving, nature-loving worldview. Anybody who does that is a cousin of mine, whether they're Native Americans or Sufis or, you know, doesn't matter.
Daniel Kemmes is a political scientist and author of several books, including one of my all-time favorites, Community and the Politics of Place. He addresses the need to change our mainstream cultural perspective.
What I have come to believe more and more strongly is that we're now passing through a period in political history that is much more profound than we're generally aware of. And what I believe it really amounts to is that, well, for 200 years we have lived under the sway of the nation state as the defining political entity. That period of history is ready to pass, as all periods of history do pass, and that we're moving now in the direction of the recognition of organic forms at all different levels. The most important of those levels is the most local, and that localism comes down, I think, finally to very small units, to neighborhoods at least. And what you recognize about neighborhoods immediately is they are organic. You can't tell something by drawing straight lines on a map, this is going to be a neighborhood. You can only ask it, what is the neighborhood here? And then it defines itself. And you move up from there to the city, and then the organic relationship between a city and its surrounding countryside. And there again, you can't tell an area what that organic relationship is going to be. But if you ask, if you pay attention to how do city and countryside relate to each other, you see an organic form emerge. I think politically we're going to see that happen all the way up through the continental level and finally to the global level. I think we have to be willing to exercise citizenship and politics at all of those levels. But I also believe that the way in which nationhood has defined our political thinking and acting is ready now to soften, if not dissolve.
My friend Gary Paul Nabhan, co-founder of the Native Seed Search, is an ethnobiologist and poet who has authored many books and has made huge contributions to our understanding of the necessity for not only protecting but also forwarding diversity on every level. He is indeed one of our most forward-thinking counterculturalists.
Many people think that my work with Native Seed Search and Seed Savers Exchange is about seed diversity only, that we're talking about diversified genetics in our corn and beans and squash. What we're really doing is using that as a symbol, as a light to shine upon the need for structural diversity in our agricultural system, not just small farms, but medium-scale farms and some kinds of large-scale farms as well. Not just good Anglo farmers, but good Hispanic farmers, good Hopi farmers that have different points of view on how to use the land, that see things in the land that one culture alone cannot see. And so we're really not just focused on the diversity of livestock breeds or seeds alone. We really want that to be part of a suite of strategies that I think sanction, justify, and celebrate the cultural diversity that has been the great stewards and diversifiers of cultivated and domesticated plants and animals. And so when you think of Hopi corn, just don't think of multicolored corn. Think of how each Hopi village, each clan, has selected that corn differently over thousands of years, and that they've interacted with the Tewa and Navajo and Southern Paiute and perhaps even the prehistoric Hohokam and Anasazi, the prehistoric Puebloan people. And each of those cultures has selected corn for different characteristics, for drought tolerance, for deep rooting, for use as a hominy corn, for use as a peaky corn, for use as a cornmeal for blessings. And that without that whole suite of cultural viewpoints, we would have never gotten to the point that we are today, where we can see 30 different races of Hopi corn still grown in an area about the size of Albuquerque.
My friend William DeBuise is one of the greatest writers in the North American Southwest and has grappled with life's greatest questions ever since he settled into his farm ranch in northern New Mexico in the early 1970s. He was spawned a counterculturalist and evolved into one of our great environmental activists and is himself a human example of where the counterculture movement now resides to a very great extent.
Most people through most of human history have lived in something like a steady state economy. This continuous growth way of life that we define as normal today is really an artifact of the modern era in Western Europe and exported to North America and really to the rest of the world today. But that's not where human beings evolved. That's not where we lived for all those millennia beforehand. We can do this. And that's the wisdom that we get from Native people, because they're still connected to that other reality, that longer heritage of human experience, and can draw on traditional knowledge about how that steady state world existed and what kind of values were necessary to underpin it. We are citizens of so many commons all the time. You know, in a sense, the atmosphere, which we're polluting with greenhouse gases, is a commons. Our watersheds are a commons. qualities like silence is a commons. These days in America, you can hardly go any public place without hearing a dog on TV yammering away. Commons is what we share with each other, and somehow linked to this idea of transitioning to a steady state economy, we've got to transition to a set of values that is rooted in what we share together, rooted in a sense of community, rooted in our bonds to each other, rather than in our individual existences to the degree we are so preoccupied today. And where that leads is to an emphasis on quality of life rather than on quantity of consumption. Bill McKibben has done some very interesting work and has tracked a number of interesting trends and polling systems and so forth. And he is fond of citing the fact that it seems that as Americans have accumulated more possessions, they report themselves as being less happy. More toys doesn't mean more fun. And I think as we take this consumer society to its accumulating, trash-producing reductio ad absurdum, we're finding that it's not a very satisfactory way to live. So somewhere down the line, if we're going to be successful, if we're going to get into the future more or less intact, we've got to reorient our values to the primacy of the commons, to a sense of loyalty to place, to a sense of dedication to quality of life, rather than just to the continuous consumption of more and more material.
Melissa Savage is a biogeographer who moved to San Francisco in 1967 in time to witness the Summer of Love that was a milestone in hippie history. She befriended activists including Keith Lampe, a.k.a. Ponderosa Pine, and poet Gary Snyder. Today, she is a top scientist deeply involved in restoration ecology.
There's been a lot of work in restoration between the Canadian and the Colorado, and indeed in the West, but especially in the Southwest. It's been a kind of a leader in restoration. There's been a lot of attention focused on things like forests, forest health, and the role of fire. And I've been involved in a lot of forest restoration, which is important because forests are such a huge habitat. There are, 8 million acres of ponderosa pine in the Southwest, in the Colorado Plateau, and another 7 or 8 million of pinyon juniper. The main focus of restoration now, fortunately, I think, has moved toward a recognition that human understanding is fairly inadequate and human efforts are pretty puny in trying to do something like restoring really complex ecosystems. But what we do have a handle on is what kinds of processes were native to these ecosystems. And so what we're trying to do is define the envelope of natural processes and try to push ecosystems to be within that envelope. And so then the natural world can take over and restore itself in a way, heal itself.
Rena Swensel was born into the Tewa Indian culture at the Santa Clara Pueblo on the western bank of the northern Rio Grande and taught me to heed the wisdom inherent in perspectives of traditional indigenous peoples on this continent.
I think that the Pueblos have now joined the rest of the world and lifestyle, and I think that there isn't the concern with being in connection with the land, with the water, with the birds, with the trees, that it's gone to really going to work 8 to 5, having a job outside the community, and the swirl of life in the community is really disrupted by the kind of economic system that we've given ourselves to, which is you work from 8 to 5 and then the rest of the time you're supposed to recover so you can go back to work from 8 to 5. And there isn't any more that real vitality that happens in a community that is about just living there, just being there. We've really moved away from that. But what we do have left are the remembrances of the way it used to be. And also, I think there's some knowledge there that is still very, very important for the rest of the world. And that is how we do live in this place that we are a part of, how we acknowledge that the mountains do contain us, embrace us, that the sky overhead is still something that we need to relate to. And you know, it's so dry out there right now. I walk around in my yard and I walk through it and it's just dusting up again. It's that we seem to go through cycles of that sort, where the dust is just kicking up and blowing around. What we were before all of this going to work stuff and being so concerned with buying the latest gadget or whatever we need to buy, was that we were really concerned with talking to the clouds, talking to the wind, talking to the water, and being one with all of those forces that we really, really need to be in touch with. We become so separated from that reality, from the real reality.
Again, Gary Paul Nabhan.
When I think about global climate change, I think about it as global climatic destabilization and increase in the uncertainty and unpredictability of whole systems. And to some extent, what I trust to get us out of that is the people at the grassroots level that are living with that uncertainty every day. I don't think global climate change will be settled by a top-down solution from Kyoto, Copenhagen, or Washington. I've spent the last year interviewing heirloom chili pepper farmers from the Yucatan Peninsula to the Rio Arriba, northern New Mexico, to St. Augustine, Florida, to Avery Island in Louisiana. And I trust the vernacular human capacity to adapt to changing conditions and to find innovations emerge from the stuff in front of us. And I don't think that top-down solutions from governments or from the scientific priesthood are going to get us where we need to be. So I'm back to believing that community-based knowledge is more dynamic than either governmental dogma or scientific dogma.
Here, Bill DeBuise tells of John Wesley Powell's intent to organize the American West by watersheds rather than the geopolitical organization that has come to prevail.
John Wesley Powell. Here we see his map of the major watersheds of the so-called arid lands, along with their sub-watersheds in different shadings. And he proposed that the governance of the West be organized watershed by watershed. And if you look closely at this, you can see how completely he ignored state boundaries, which is a wonderful, wonderful relief from the usual division of the landscape of the West. This was the first true bioregional plan.
Bioregionalism is one of the great contributions of the counterculture. The term was coined in the early 1970s to encompass a new take on an ancient perspective. Gary Snyder, poet and environmental philosopher, provided me with his definition of bioregionalism one summer day in 1985. It remains one of the best definitions to date.
Bioregionalism is a kind of creative branch of the anarchist, and on the other side, a creative branch of the environmental movement that strives to re-achieve indigeneity, re-achieve aboriginality by learning about the place and what really goes on there. And bioregionalism goes beyond simple geography or biology by its cultural concern, its human concern, as well as its sort of natural history, scientific-type concern. Its cultural concern is to not only know the plants and animals of a place, but to know the cultural information of how have people then lived there who knew how to do it, thus the interest in, say, American Indians, that kind of ethnicity, and then knowing what the deeper mythic, spiritual, archetypal implications of Douglas fir or coyote or blue jay might be, to know from both inside and outside what the total implications of being in place are. So it becomes a study not only of place, but a study of psyche in place. And that's what makes it so interesting. It's in a way, it seems to me, the first truly concrete step that has been taken since Kropotkin in stating how we decentralize ourselves after the 20th century.
Roxanne Swenzel lives in the adobe home she built with her own hands on the Santa Clara Indian Pueblo in northern New Mexico. She is a world-class sculptress and has practiced permaculture for well over 30 years.
I was introduced to permaculture in about 1985 by Joel Glansberg, who had just taken a permaculture design course with Bill Mollison. He told me about the concepts of permaculture, and the way I understood it at the time was that it was some cool ideals from Australia that put house and place in a way that was sustainable. So using solar energy, using water catchments, using plants and animals to diversify that place in order that you can sustain yourself off of that location. We began to do that in my yard here, right here. And right now it's a forest. Back then it was literally a driveway. I had already started building the house, and I already knew about solar because of my daddy and my mom. And I knew I was going to build me a passive solar house. But Joel added the dimension of, let's make a forest around the house. So we started forming the landscape to catch water and anything organic that we could, because it was sand. And so we were making swales and planting nitrogen-fixing shrubs and anything we could, because it was pretty dead. There wasn't much life going on here. So we began the process. And what I loved about it was that it fit into how I was brought up here, connecting to place. For me, it was an obvious 1, 2, 3 step into my culture, because who were the original permaculturists here? It was the Pueblo people. And the Pueblo people had figured out how to live in this environment. And it's not an easy environment because it's high desert. My people had figured out how to live here for thousands of years, sustainably. And I realized I needed to learn more what that was about. So it's just been a process of learning more and more about my culture, Pueblo culture, historically, you know, what's left today, and then actually trying to put back what I've learned back into what we've lost. And it's been, yeah, my drive, my purpose.
Again, Gary Snyder.
I see a lot of interest all the time, of course, in the counterculture, generally combined in a lot of people's minds with the New Age. And counterculture in people's thinking ranges from Beat Generation and then punk and then, gosh, all the way through gay, lesbian rights and now probably immigration rights and so forth. It's all lumped together in a funny kind of way. And I'd like to sort it out more. I would like to see other people sort it out. The territory that interests me, starting, say, with a consciousness of Native Americans and a consciousness of the place and of the landscape, is first to see the connection of those. Now, you can talk about interest in Native Americans from a lot of different standpoints, obviously, and the more New Agey way is the spiritual thing. And then a sub-variety of that is the effect of peyote and other psychedelics borrowed from Native cultures here and there on the earlier days of the subculture, as though that were something people were looking toward, were getting from Native Americans. And I was interested in the spiritual life of Native Americans, too. And I was delighted to discover how I could make my own sweat lodge and take a sweat bath in it. I found it very refreshing. I mean, I immediately got an insight into what was going on there. For some of us, myself included, there is a bundle of connected values that is respect for nature, recognition of the importance of place, and grasping that nature happens somewhere always. It's not an abstraction. and that in turn translates into ecosystems, biomes, if you want to get biological with it, or bioregions also. So we have a lineage from Native American to bioregions. And then that is enforced again by the ethics of Buddhism and the concern for all living beings, which informs modern ecology to some small degree. In the current world situation where we're looking at resurgent American imperialism in some parts of the political culture, of the globalized economy with the United States being one of the leaders in the globalization of the economy, and this converging with the very tardy realization of how fragile a fossil fuel-based economy is. When you come up against that and then look at what set of alternative possible scenarios are there for the future, the prime values encoded in the ecological Buddhist bioregional bundle, including its religious and artistic history so far, is of prime value. It carries some of the key values that we might want to look at. The alternative counterculture is a vector of considerable use and value.
The counterculture in its myriad forms is one of our greatest resources. It has evolved as a subcultural phenomenon in America, at least since the time of Henry David Thoreau. It has kept reactive pace with mainstream culture that has been directed mainly by economics, as economic growth for its own sake finally came to be seen as destructive to planetary habitat. An exponential increase in extinction of species, the counterculture movement invigorated the modern environmental movement, as well as recognition of a spiritual relationship with nature. We are finally coming to realize that we are spawned as a natural phenomenon on this planet Earth, that we are of this Earth, that our true allegiance is to this Earth. Many of us within the counterculture have attempted to absorb the teachings of our Native American friends and guides. In this time of profound cultural conflict, I foresee a new wave from within the underground. It will blaze its own trail and define its own characteristics. Perhaps it will result in some more appropriate form of decentralized governance based on a system of ethics more in keeping with nurturing homeland and sowing seeds of diversity of perspective into the commons of human consciousness. Today we have heard the voices of Peter Coyote, Reno Meyerson, Daniel Chemis, Gary Paul Nabhan, William DeBuise, Melissa Savage, Rena Swensel, Gary Snyder, and Roxanne Swensel. Our music was performed on the guitar by Carl Bernstein. Voices of Counterculture is funded by grants from the Museum of New Mexico Foundation and the Christensen Fund in San Francisco. Our radio series coincides with Voices of Counterculture in the Southwest, a major exhibition on display at the New Mexico History Museum at the Palace of the Governors in Santa Fe, extending from May 14, 2017 through February 11, 2018. The exhibition is accompanied by a book entitled Voices of Counterculture in the Southwest, published by the Museum of New Mexico Press. For Voices of Counterculture, this is Jack Leffler. Thank you for listening.